Hi, I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of the new Contemporary Lifestyle Radio Show for Women Over 40, featuring everything about your health, wealth, children, happiness, and anything else of interest to you, the listener. Please stay tuned. Today we'll be talking with two women working in the public sector, analyzing and educating Americans regarding economic behavior, immigration trends, public policy, and other factors currently facing Americans. Elaine Mag is a senior research associate in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute, where she studies income support programs for low-income families and children. Before joining Urban, Mag worked at the Internal Revenue Service and Government Accountability Office as a Presidential Management Fellow. She has advised congressional staff on the taxation of families with children, higher education incentives, and work incentives in the tax code. Diane Lim is a principal economist at the Conference Board, where she develops, conducts, and communicates research as part of the board's economics program. She studies and speaks on a wide variety of topics with a focus on the role of public policy in influencing economic behavior and outcomes. Prior to this, Lim served as vice president of economic research at the Committee for Economic Development, the public policy arm of the Conference Board. She is also an adjunct professor at George Washington University and Georgetown University. So welcome, Elaine and Diane.
Thank you.
Let's talk briefly about the state of our economy and where we stand on fiscal and economic policies. Given the sentiment that put Donald Trump into office, what is your prognosis for the country? What are the prognosticators predicting? And better yet, what's the buzzword in your offices around the water cooler? Because I'm sure it's nothing like my water cooler. Diane?
Well, the economy is doing pretty well right now. We have just been climbing slowly out of one of the deepest recessions in our nation's history, and we are at very low unemployment. We've finally gotten to very low unemployment, and I think economists are convinced that we are near what economists call full employment, where we're at full capacity, and we're starting to see wages rise, although maybe not as fast as we would normally like to see. And I think that, you know, this is a natural kind of high point in the business cycle. So it's going to be interesting to sort out what the effects of the incoming Trump administration are for the condition of the economy, simply because we're already kind of doing a lot better than we had been in previous years. Obviously, the recovery thus far has nothing to do with Donald Trump's policies. But it'll be interesting to see what the Trump administration will try to claim credit for and how the Trump administration's policies are going to affect that recovery path, as well as the path going forward for longer-term economic growth.
So just to clarify something, you said we're at full capacity, or the verbiage you use for where you expect that the economy is in full throttle with regard to jobs. Does that mean that there's always an underbelly of approximately 4.6% not filled? Is that correct?
Yeah, even when the economy is kind of going at full blast, there's always some measure of unemployment, which is just how many people are currently not working relative to the number of people who do want to work, who count themselves as in the labor force, meaning if they're not working, they're looking for work, they want to work. So the reason why there's always some unemployment is that people transition, there's friction, what economists call frictional unemployment, which is people between jobs. It's very difficult to get unemployment to zero, obviously, at any point in time, because people are always going to be between jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get past what's considered a low rate of unemployment, to keep trying to get more and more people to work, if most of the labor force who wants to find a job has a job, then if you continue to push policies that keep increasing demand for goods and services and therefore require more jobs, more positions to be filled, you're going to start creating inflation, because there'll be almost too much demand relative to the capacity of the economy to produce, to satisfy that demand for goods and services. So that is the kind of traditional inflation-unemployment trade-off that economists worry about, is you want to get as close to full capacity, working on all cylinders as you can, but you don't want to overheat the economy, because then you create too much demand relative to supply, and that generates inflation.
And Elaine, real briefly, what's going on at your water cooler?
So what we are watching at the Tax Policy Center is we're trying to see, is Donald Trump going to try to push part or all of the tax policy he proposed during his campaign through? He's got a Speaker of the House who has been talking about tax reform for a while now and is ready to go. And so we'll be sort of watching to see which ideas percolate to the top and which ones don't. And we'll be reacting to that by providing as much information about these policies as we can, so hopefully we can inform the debate and get better choices.
So do you think that a new government will bring, for example, new jobs? That was one of the many reasons why his popularity continued to soar, because he was making these predictions and these promises. I guess from your vantage point, and I'm not asking you personally, obviously I'm asking you professionally, do you think that people really believe him? And do you really sense that if any of this is possible, was the election ever intended to hurt the current movers and shakers, or that the American population would just like something new? Diane?
Well, I think the reason Donald Trump was elected has a lot to do with the sense of unfairness that many people in America feel about their economic status in the country. I think that there's a natural common over-attribution that Americans always place on the presidency in terms of how much the president influences the economy. Political incumbents always do poorly in elections when the economy's in bad shape, and they do well when the economy's in good shape and they can claim credit for it. The fact of the matter is, for better or worse, the conditions of the economy, the macroeconomy, really have very little to do with a particular president's economic policies, because the economy is influenced by market forces, and those market forces are way greater than the little tweaks that we might be able to make to those, you know, to that market system through tax and spending, government tax and spending policy. Certainly, the levers that the president can pull or influence are those tax and spending policies much more than monetary policy. And monetary policy is probably a lot more influential on, in terms of the overall macroeconomic activity in the country, because that's a very big and powerful lever to increase the money supply or to tighten it. So I think what appealed to the voters in the Midwest, particularly middle-class voters that have faced tough times, both from a combination of the decline of the manufacturing sector and because of the recession that all of us face, they came out of that with a perception that while the rest of the economy in general is recovering, that their lives don't feel the same economically as they did before the Great Recession. And I think they blamed a lot of that, the fact that other people in other parts of the country, in the cities, the college-educated group, the more white-collar occupations, seemed to do better in this recovery than they did in the manufacturing belt. And I think there's a sense of unfairness and this attribution to maybe Obama's policies, that Obama's policies were not tailored enough, despite the fact that Obama did a lot to help the auto industry. Somehow voters came out of this recession with this perception that the government did not do enough for the manufacturing sector of our economy and for the Midwest part of our country. And I think Trump took advantage of that and made claims that under his administration it would be very different, that he would prioritize the people that are feeling left behind, that he would know how to create all these jobs for that part of the country. And I think a lot of Americans frankly decided, what did they have to lose to vote for him? Because it seemed like a big change. They essentially have been dissatisfied with how things have been going for them, and they were essentially willing to trade off a more certain economic course under Hillary Clinton for this unknown thing, you know, behind door number two with Donald Trump. They were willing to trade it because they felt like they would not have benefited that much from Hillary Clinton's policies anyway.
And just briefly, Elaine, back to the original question, there must be a real disconnect between the general public's understanding of what new government can do for them and how a president can actually affect such change versus what Diane was talking about, correct?
Yeah, I definitely agree with Diane on this, that there's a real disconnect. What I would say is people need to think about the president as not creating jobs or taking jobs away, but hopefully influencing policy. And the policies that the president can influence, but they need the Congress to come along with, come support policies. The government can provide additional transfer benefits, such as food stamps. The government can increase tax credits, such as the Earned Income Tax Credit, which helps low-income working families. So it's these smaller things that the government actually can do. It's not these huge changes that I think people might be hoping for.
So let's talk about perceptions and realities of the generations. Let's start with you, Diane. Just in a bullet point format, what do you think that young people have to worry about right now in our current economy? And how is their outlook different from, say, millennials or baby boomers? And ultimately, what will the impact of anything that's about to happen be for them moving forward in the future?
Yeah, I think if by young people you mean people who are just coming into the workforce
yes.
now, what I think of millennials as those between like 18 and 35 right now. Maybe that's too broad of a category, but I think of them as my children. My children are between 18 and 25. I certainly think of all of them as millennials,
mm-hmm.
and they're just coming into the workforce. You know, I think because they kind of came of age during the Great Recession and during not great economic times, and they also came of age during a lot of dysfunction in the federal government, I think that they do have a different attitude about reliance on government to solve their problems or to pave the way for their economic success. So I think young people are not counting on, I can tell you for sure, they're not counting on the major federal benefit programs to be there for them, like Social Security and Medicare, the retirement age benefit programs, because they hear about the shortfalls in those systems financially. They know that older Americans aren't willing to pay higher taxes to support the sustainability of those programs. And so they are definitely looking toward how can they best secure their own economic future without counting on these government support programs. They're different. They have different preferences. I mean, I'm overgeneralizing now, but I can tell you that young people these days, they do not seem to have the sort of economic goals on their list that my generation did. You know, when I was in high school and college, I sort of had a checklist of things that I wanted to do as a grown-up, like go to college, go to grad school if you want to, but get married, or get a job, get married, buy a house, have kids. You know, there's sort of this list of things. And a lot of those things on the checklist, frankly, cost a lot of money, especially the idea of buying a home and finding a job that's high paying. I feel like the baby boomer generation was a little bit more focused on the financial rewards to work rather than the kind of intrinsic rewards to working, and that we were more focused on the need for a high income in order to support our consumption needs and wants, and that it was a very big part of baby boomers' sort of economic success was home ownership. And I just think that young people, the millennials, are not as interested in buying a home, both because they saw their parents, the problem with their parents being so invested in homes that didn't end up holding their value, you know, were not good investments. They turned out to be just major consumption items. And they don't want to be tied down with that financial burden. They also don't want to be tied down physically to a home. They want to be more mobile. They want to be more agile in terms of moving to the next best, the most exciting new job, even if it doesn't pay a lot of money. They definitely value the whole experience of being a working American much more than I feel like my generation did. I feel like a lot of my friends that are my age, they think of their job as a job and maybe a career, but they don't think of it as their life's passion. And so I think my kids are definitely they're not looking for the highest paying job. They're looking for the most satisfying job. And they're looking for a job that does not necessarily pay a lot of money, because they know that it doesn't take a lot of money. It takes a sufficient amount of money to be happy, but it doesn't take a lot of money to be happy and live a fulfilling life. And I think that's a healthy difference between the younger and the older, and I think they've learned from the mistakes of their parents.
But if I take your words and I really interpret them backwards, it sounds as if they are living much more in the immediacy, much more in the moment. But I worry.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I have two generations of two kids, and I worry dearly because life might be fine, but when they're incapable of working or when they're at the point at which they need additional benefits, maybe because they've become sick, there's just no cushion here. Would you agree?
Yes, I would agree. They definitely live for the moment. And so a problem, a downside of this new kind of live for the moment attitude of the millennials is they are not planning enough for the future. I mean, I think they're more cautious in saving for the future. And like if they have a good job, they are participating in their retirement savings programs at work, largely because those programs have gotten better at making sure their employees are aware of the benefits of retirement savings, of defaulting them into putting aside money into their retirement savings programs. I think if our children are lucky enough to be working for employers that provide benefits, that's great because they will take advantage of those. The worry is that a lot of younger Americans are working these kind of non-standard jobs or contingent jobs. You know, the gig economy is younger and female workers who want the flexibility. But the downside of that is those kinds of jobs don't come with built-in benefits because it's not a traditional employer-employee relationship. So I think we do have to kind of keep an eye on how many in our workforce are actually facing larger economic insecurity just because we're starting to move away more and more from the traditional relationship with our employer and the traditional support system.
So looking at this a little more comprehensively, what do you look for and predict for the next 25, 30 years of their lives if they're not capable or able of gathering money the way that we did or our parents' generation did? How are they actually going to support themselves in older age?
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens with our federal income support programs and our retirement security programs relative to the private sector's savings plans. I think one concern will be that if the federal government doesn't get its act together in terms of Social Security and Medicare's financial health, it means that our children are going to be faced with higher taxes and or lower benefits in the future. So the concern will be that some of these younger people may not have the systems in place to adequately save privately for their own retirement security. And on top of that, the government programs are not going to be as generous toward their retirement security. I try to be optimistic, and once the baby boomers have kind of aged out of the system, you know, because they've basically died off, our children, the younger generations, are going to be more in charge. They're going to have a stronger voice in politics and in policy. And unfortunately, the baby boomers are probably going to retire and be fully supported, and we're probably going to hold harmless all the baby boomers, even the youngest of the baby boomers, from any benefit cuts or tax increases. But I think that the younger generation has it in their own self-interest to make sure that the government's finances are in strong order at the same time that they progress through their careers and become middle-aged people. I think they're going to be I'm not worried about their own motivation to be responsible both from a private personal standpoint as well as from a public policy standpoint. I just think that we have to make sure that the older generations who are now still in charge of public policies and businesses are doing the right thing in terms of not wasting, squandering resources on things that are not going to help the younger generations, both in the public policy and in the private sector, in terms of investing in things that are going to help make the economy of the future 20, 30 years from now stronger, hopefully, than the economy is today.
Mm-hmm. So, Elaine, because we're a show for women and men over 40, when we talk about midlife, there was always that tried and true truism that you would be retiring at 62. But truthfully, midlife is the beginning for a lot of people. And now with new older parenting and a host of other external factors, this mid group is becoming a sandwich generation. So what are your thoughts about this? There has been a movement encouraging older people to go back to work for longer. How does this impact our society?
What we see is that people are working longer and they're holding on to these good jobs, and that makes them unavailable to younger people coming into the job market for as long as older people are there. But they're there out of a feeling of necessity in many cases. So for a low-income person, if you have not accumulated enough savings over your lifetime, then a good way to continue to live at the lifestyle you want to live at is to continue working. And so we do see that happening. We also, though, think about the tax system comes into play throughout your life course. And we see this sort of middle generation right now looks different than it used to. So it used to be that you got married, lived your life together, and retired, and the tax system was pretty good at handling that. But now what we see more often is that you maybe have a child before you're married. You might marry that child's other parent. You might marry someone else. Over the course of your life, a divorce may happen. This may result in children coming in and out of your household. And it's not a huge deal socially, perhaps, but because we provide so much assistance for very low-income families through the tax system, it's a problem. And I'll explain that by saying, if you have a child who receives support from multiple parents, the tax system really doesn't deal with that. It deals with the parent who the child lived with the longest can receive a fair amount of support. They can receive $1,000 a year as a child tax credit for that child. And if you're low income and working, you can also receive an earned income tax credit, which might add another $5,000 to your bottom line. If the child only lives with you part of the year, you may qualify for no benefits. So there's huge disparities in that. And that's just something the tax system hasn't caught up with and would take a real change for it to be able to catch up with the changing lifestyles. So where marriage used to be the norm and being born into a married couple used to be the norm, that's just no longer the case. Right now for low-income families, it's more likely that a child will not be born into a house with two married parents.
That is really fascinating to me because I'm always looking at the zeitgeist of things, the reason for things changing the way they are. And I'm always struck by the fact that millions of Americans are certainly living in non-traditional families rather than traditional ones. And therefore, All of these policies are going to have to keep up with all of these social mores. Correct, Diane?
Yeah, the way public policy is written is by experts here in D.C., and it's not always designed to address things other than the way things have always been, traditional families and traditional economic arrangements.
Yeah. Right, so the food stamps program, which is sort of the other big support program for low-income families, is flexible in that it's a monthly program, so as people move in and out of the household, you can go to the benefits office and change your family unit, and your benefit will reflect that change in who you're living with. But the tax system has an annual reconciliation process, right? We file our taxes in the spring following the year that we just earned income over. And that means it just cannot be as flexible as a monthly program.
So we only have a few minutes, Diane, and I wanted to just talk about the work that you feel passionate about, which is trade and immigration policies, which are not focused on individuals but are family-based.
Current immigration policy in the U.S. is designed to be a family reunification kind of policy. One thing that's interesting is that immigration can be geared more toward encouraging economic growth if it's geared toward addressing labor shortages. So that's an issue I've been working on. Obviously, Donald Trump came through the campaign with very strong views on immigration, and definitely made it sound like there was going to be less immigration in the future rather than more. I think that economist perspective, we were a little bit taken aback by that notion that immigration hurts the economy. It actually definitely is a net positive to the economy, although in some parts of the country and with some occupations, immigrant workers can be a substitute for native-born workers, and that's where the tension starts and the discontent with the idea of continuing to have quite open borders to immigrants. You know, I think with Trump, though, now that he's president-elect, everyone is just waiting to see what he actually follows through on, and there's already been a lot of softening from the wall isn't really going to be a wall, and he does seem sensitive to the idea that immigration, especially high-skilled immigration, can help the U.S. economy. And trade, he's softening his stance, his campaign stance on trade. You know, he's backing off a little bit from this idea that all trade is bad and focusing more on the idea that the trade agreements have been poorly negotiated in the past and that he's going to get better deals. I think the big concern with Donald Trump, the rhetoric that he put out during the campaign, was really creating this notion among his supporters that the economy is always a zero-sum game, that you can't include others in the U.S. economy because that'll just take away from the people who are already here. And that was, I think, what drove a lot of his support, was this notion that if it is a zero-sum game, then if Trump is going to propose cutting those other people out, then that leaves more for all of us already here. And so I think that how Trump transitions from his campaign position, and I assume it was also his true belief about how the economy works, to actually governing our country going forward and working with other countries on immigration and trade policy, it'll be interesting to see if he evolves, if he sort of learns a little bit more about the fact that it is not a zero-sum game. Similarly, with his policies for promoting jobs, his strategy is obviously going to be picking winners and losers at the specific company level. So we've already seen some of this with his influence on Carrier, with his talk about Boeing more recently. He's getting very ground level about his picking companies that will get subsidies, picking companies that will get, you know, maybe threatened to lose certain government contracts. And I think that that's problematic because, again, it's setting up an us versus them attitude. Like, companies are going to be quick to stand in line and to curry favor from Donald Trump because the first in line is the most likely to get a subsidy or a good deal. And soon we're going to run out of money because he can't keep negotiating company by company without quickly running out of money. And the idea of picking winners and losers at the company level or regional level is kind of scary for an economist because that is not an efficient way to allocate our resources in our country.
Elaine, any final thoughts?
My final thought is that we are in an era of uncertainty, and we don't know what's going to happen in the tax and budget world. And so it's important that people actually try to understand the policies, find trusted news sources to help them wade through those policies, and really try to think about not just what happens to me under this policy, but what happens to my country and large groups of people who may be struggling under this policy, and figure out what kind of policies ought we be favoring in the future.
We've been talking with two women about tax policies, the implications of a new president, our current immigration system, and a host of other fascinating topics. Thank you so much, Diane and Elaine, for joining me today.
Thank you, Sima.
Diane Lim can be found on Twitter at EconomistMom, Elaine Mag at TaxPolicyCenter.org. I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of Four Women Over 40, and to the listener, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. And until next time, I hope you take care.